Welcome back, friends, as we examine the documents of Vatican II. In this episode, we're going to look at two particular documents. One, Orientalium Ecclesiarum on the Eastern Churches, and two, Unitatis Redintegratio on the restoration of unity on ecumenism. In the first document we're going to look at on the Eastern Churches, we have to remember that there are two aspects to church in the Catholic tradition. There is the Latin Church and the Eastern Church. When the apostles first started in Jerusalem, that was the nucleus of the church. And then as they went out to the world and started preaching the gospel, and the church began to grow, and especially after the church was legalized with the Edict of Milan, 313 by Constantine, and now it was no longer an underground religion, and they were allowed to be established, we see what we call patriarchs being formed. And in the ancient church, there were five patriarchs. And these patriarchs were bishops who were in charge of a large geographical region and of a particular tradition. Now, Jerusalem, of course, being the first, was a patriarch. And so the patriarch of Jerusalem was in charge of that area and the way in which they celebrated the liturgical worship of the church. There's the patriarch of Rome, and that's the Pope. He's the patriarch of the West and the city of Rome, and also the whole Western church. There was a patriarch established in Antioch and in Alexandria, and then later on in Constantinople, named after the Emperor Constantine himself, in the old town of Byzantium. And from that we get the whole word for the Byzantine church, which is now present-day Istanbul. These patriarchal churches were configured in such a way that the patriarch was a bishop among other bishops to whom they would go to for advice and counsel, and he had some jurisdictional authority over the other bishops in terms of assignments and who got placed where, if there were any disputes. The Pope, however, was always considered the head, the first among equals, primus inter pares, but also the supreme head of all the other patriarchal sees. We don't see a division in this until the 11th century, when in 1054, the Eastern Orthodox Church begins to emerge, separates itself from union in Rome. And so the Patriarch of Constantinople becomes the titular head, in a sense, of the Eastern Orthodox Church. And then within that, we'll see later on, the Patriarch of Moscow is formed. So they split, in a sense, from Constantinople. Now Moscow is the Russian Orthodox is distinct from the Greek Orthodox. But in the beginning, they were all one, even though they had different ways of worshiping, expressing the faith. And yet the content was always the same. Same seven valid sacraments. The Mass was the same, that the words of Christ at the institution, the consecration, were exactly the same. This is my body, this is my blood. However, little nuances and different external aspects were dramatically different in the Eastern Church. Much more mystical, much more surrounding itself on the transcendent, whereas in the Western Church, we see concentration on the human suffering of Christ. You'll see a crucifix with Jesus portrayed there. In the Eastern Church, you'll see icons where you've got Jesus, Christ the King, all right, depicted. Jesus as the High Priest. Both very valid. The Eastern Church making a lot of reference and symbolic depictions of Christ, the resurrected Lord, Christ the King reigning in heaven. In the Latin Church, a great emphasis on the redemptive aspect of Christ. So, sort of two sides of the same coin. This document, in paragraph 1, begins by saying, "The Catholic Church values highly the institutions of the Eastern Churches and their liturgical rites, ecclesiastical traditions, and their ordering for Christian life." Now, we mentioned the different patriarchal sees. There's also different traditions that come about from these patriarchs. In the Latin Church that most of us are familiar with, we see the Mass as it's been handed down to us in recent times in the vernacular. But before Vatican II, from the time of Trent, the Latin Mass, which is sometimes called the Tridentine Mass, was exactly the same all over the world. You could go anywhere, no matter what language you spoke, The Mass was celebrated in the exact same fashion. This was sort of begun even before Trent in the time of Charlemagne, because being the Holy Roman Emperor wanted some uniformity. And so we see a standardization of incorporating official Latin language, which was the language of the empire, so that everybody could go anywhere and make sure that they received the sacraments in the same fashion. In the introduction of the vernacular since the time of Vatican II, it's the same words, just in our own native tongue. But it's the same words of consecration, the same words of baptism. I baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, instead of ego te baptizo nomine Patris Filii Spiritus Sancti. It means the same thing. In the Eastern Church, we have different expressions, different traditions. From Alexandria, we've got the Coptic Church, the Ethiopian Church. From Antioch, we've got the Syrian, the Maronite, the Malankar. We have the Armenian Church. We have in the Byzantine Church, which incorporates the Greek, the Ruthenian, the Melkite, Ukrainian, and we've got the Chaldean. Since the new code of canon law, the Western Code in 1983, and then the Oriental Code, we don't even call these Eastern churches rites anymore, but churches in their own distinct privilege, so that the Ruthenian Church, the Ukrainian Church, cannot be lumped all together, well, they're just Byzantine. They are a distinct church in their own right, but they're all united under the Holy Father. So we have to respect the way they celebrate their Mass of the Divine Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, or if it's the Liturgy of St. Basil, looks very much exactly like the Orthodox liturgy, but they are in union with Rome. This document reminds us, in paragraph 5, this Holy Council not merely praises and appreciates, as is due, the ecclesiastical and spiritual heritage, but also insists on viewing it as the heritage of the whole Church of Christ. We, as Catholics, we have these brothers and sisters of ours who are equal members of our church. So many times I hear people say, well, Father, we went to this Byzantine church. Did it count? Did it count? That was the real presence. I, as a Latin Rite Catholic, can go to a Byzantine church, and if they're in union with Rome, I can receive the sacraments anytime if I'm properly disposed. If I'm able to receive in my church, I can receive in their church. They're with us. They're united with us. They pray for John Paul, the Pope of Rome. Jurisdictionally, they have bishops like we do. We have the in the Passaic Diocese of New Jersey, or the Metropolitan See of Pittsburgh for the Ruthenians. Their territory covers just territory like we do in the Latin Rite. And we can people get married in those churches, they can get buried. Now, where we differentiate would be in terms of if the rite of the father or the husband has precedence, there are little canonical things that have to be observed, and then the rite of the children should follow according to canon law. But if I go to Mass, I'm going to Mass. I'm receiving the real Christ. I'm fulfilling my Sunday obligation. Going to the Orthodox Church, however, even though it's a valid, true sacrament, they're not in full union with the Holy See. There's where we're going to look at in a few moments. But the Byzantine Church, they're with us. They're part of us. They're equal members. They're not subservient, low-class Catholics. They are equal, full members. Paragraph 6 reminds us the Eastern churches should be firmly convinced that they can and ought always preserve their own legitimate liturgical rites and ways of life, and that changes are to be introduced only to forward their own organic development. In the Eastern Church, they use icons as opposed to statues. They also receive communion standing up, whereas in the Western, we had the tradition of receiving kneeling down, usually at a communion railing until recent times. In the Eastern Church, the standing position was a sign of respect. Kneeling was not as common in the Eastern Church as it was in the Western Church. In the East, they stood, especially in Easter, they stood for the whole Mass. And the Divine Liturgy in the Eastern Church can last 2 to 3 hours every Sunday. Imagine standing as a sign of reverence, though. This was their way of showing their love of Christ. So there's lots of icons, never any statues. They have the iconostasis, which is a doorway into the sanctuary, covered with icons of Jesus and of Mary, Theotokos. There are no stations of the cross, lots of candles, lots of pictures on the wall depicting the life of Christ. And all chanting. The readings are chanted. There's not too much musical instruments, but everything is chanted. And there's lots of incense, tons of it. Incense coming from the Old Testament, may my prayers rise up to you like burning incense. Lots of incense, lots of bells, lots of mystery. The whole idea of the icon is that you're looking into heaven through a window, but because we're still sinful, we're still here on earth, you don't see as clearly because of our sin. That's why the icons sometimes look a little distorted. It's not because the artist wasn't doing a good job. It's purposely done that way. It's not three-dimensional, as in Western art. It's two-dimensional and a little bit distorted because I'm looking with sinful eyes, peeking into heaven. But the icon is a way in which I can take a little glimmer into that awesome mystery, which is paradise. The document goes on in paragraph 8. The patriarchs of the Eastern Church, although some are of later date than others, all equal in patriarchal rank without prejudice to their legitimate established precedence and honor. That tells us that the patriarch of the Byzantine Church of a particular liturgical tradition has full rank. The only one that outranks the patriarch would be the Pope as supreme head of the church. They're not to be considered, put them with the Orthodox and the Protestant ministers when you're having a big celebration at the cathedral. They're with us, so they're the Byzantine priest, the Byzantine deacon, the Byzantine bishop should be with everyone else of the Latin rite because we belong to the same church. And the document goes on to tell us, in paragraph 12, the Holy Ecumenical Council confirms and approves the ancient discipline concerning the sacraments. In the Eastern Church, they give baptism, confirmation, and first Eucharist together. The person is fully initiated as a baby. So the baby's baptized, chrismated, which means confirmation, and given the precious body and blood of Christ. All at the same time, whereas we in the Western Church, we're baptized as a baby, we make our first communion in second grade, and sometimes we get confirmation in eighth grade, high school, sixth grade, depends on what diocese you're in. But we don't put them all together as they do consistently in the Eastern Church. This document says they should retain their tradition, the icons, the timing of the sacraments. The Byzantine priests are allowed to marry. Their bishops are not married, but the Byzantine priests are allowed to be married, but they must be married before they're ordained. Once they're ordained, they cannot get married. That was changed for priests in the North America, but in other parts of the world, the Byzantine clergy may be married. Celibacy is not mandatory for them. And the document concludes with reference to the Orthodox, our relationship to them. It focuses primarily on our relationship to the Eastern Catholics, but to the Eastern Orthodox, they have valid sacraments. And it tells us that if in an absolute emergency, and a person cannot physically or morally get to a Roman Catholic church, that they could go to an Orthodox church to satisfy their Sunday obligation, because it's a true valid Mass. Now, there's not intercommunion between our two churches, not because we don't believe they're valid sacraments, but there's not total unity because they do not accept the primacy, the jurisdictional primacy or the infallible teaching magisterium of the Holy See. So because of that, we don't have an open policy on communion. It's not the same with the Protestant denomination because many of them do not believe in the real presence and their ministers don't have valid orders. In the Orthodox Church, they're valid, but they're still not full communion yet. So this beautiful document reminds us how important our Eastern brothers and sisters are in the Catholic Church. So next time you go to a Byzantine church for a wedding, a funeral, or just to visit, know that you're going to a true Catholic church. Now we're going to look at another document. This one here, Intermirifica, is on social communication. Now, the Latin phrase intermirifica means among the marvelous things. That's the beginning phrase of the document. It says, man's genius has, with God's help, produced marvelous technical inventions from creation, especially in our times. And these are to advance social communication. So the very thing that EWTN is all about, social communication, this document beautifully addresses. There are different types, the press, the cinema, radio, television, and others of a like nature. Now, this was written in 1963. You could probably add now to it the internet, satellite, things that the officials could never have imagined would have developed, but that's part of social communication. Paragraph 3 tells us, the Catholic Church was founded by Christ our Lord to bring salvation to all men. You're saying, well, why such a theological statement when we're talking about radio and TV, shortwave and internet? It's to remind us that our goal, our purpose as a church is to help people get to heaven and to help them become sanctified in their lives. So these tools of the media can be employed to teach the faith. So we have all these wonderful programs on television that people learn about the faith. They learn about the catechism. They learn church history. They learn about Vatican II documents. We have devotional aspects where people can watch the Mass. They can pray the Rosary, the Divine Mercy, the Stations, when Our Holy Father went to the Holy Land. These are all things that help us. And so the Vatican Council says we should use these things. It would be to our loss and detriment if we did not. It's the Church's birthright, paragraph 3 continues, to use and own any of these media which are necessary or useful for the formation of Christians and for pastoral activity. If the media are to be correctly employed, it is essential that all those who use them know the principles of moral order and apply them faithfully in this domain. Now we get into the morality of the media. Sometimes they don't like to mention the two of them together. Morality should be in the media, not just on EWTN, but all across the board. All the major networks, satellite, cable, you name it. Because we're all moral beings. We don't put our morality off to the side and just check it in on Sunday when we go to church. I have to be a moral being every day, every minute of the day, every breath I take. Anything I use with my will and my intellect becomes a moral act. Therefore, I must ensure that they are morally good acts, or at least neutral. But if they cross the boundary line into evil, then I become sinful, and I am culpable of that. So this document tells us that the media, while it forms our knowledge of different events, there's always a moral character to this. It tells us in paragraph 7, the chronicling or description of moral evil can, with the help and the means of social communication, lead to a deeper knowledge, an analysis of man to a manifestation of the true and the good in all their splendor. If we expose the moral evil that's in the world so that people are abhorred by it and they say, we have to stop this, this is wrong. But when it's glamorized, when it's denigrating the human person, when people become desensitized to violence, to horror, to all the evils, and they say, oh, well, we see this again. We're so tired of hearing about this going on, these crimes, or the graphic depiction of crime, of ghastly things, of things that would make your stomach turn. People now are desensitized to. We're not appealing to people's base emotions here. Tell the news. Let people know something wrong is going on so that they can put a stop to it, or at least pray for people who are suffering. The document tells us that in paragraph 10, those who are receiving end of the media, especially the young, should learn moderation. It's not enough, and it's a big job to begin with, that people in media use it morally to uplift rather than to denigrate. It's not just a business, but because you're appealing to such a large audience, you should also have in the back of your mind, am I enhancing human nature with this? At the same time, the viewer has to be discriminating, not to just watch anything and everything, but that I should morally determine what I'm going to watch. Is this morally good programming? Is it uplifting? Is it true? Does this help me in any way? If I'm relaxing and just want to veg out on the sofa watching something, fine. But is that program dulling my moral sensibility? Is everybody in this TV show practicing all kinds of fornication, lying, cheating, stealing? You name one commandment and they're doing it. Does that help me? Is that my means of relaxation? The Romans did it by feeding people to the lions and bears. Are we any better in that regard? Or is this just a way that I can unwind by watching something wholesome or at least neutral? Most of all, the viewer should be responsible, paragraph 11 tells us, in using these means to form their conscience. I know what's going on in the world. For instance, if I know there's pending legislation that would put a ban on partial birth abortion, I saw that on TV, now I know I have to call my congressman, I have to write a letter. That's using it to your advantage. The doctrine also talks about responsive journalism, reporting the news accurately, but also with the right intent, not just to sell papers, not just to get high ratings, but that I want to convey the truth for the right reason. Remember T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral, when St. Thomas Becket is murdered and he's being tempted. He said, this is the greatest treason, to do the right deed for the wrong reason. Just telling the truth for no other purpose than to engage the audience in high ratings is not enough. I must want to convey the truth for the right reason. We're also advised and warned about adolescents, that they should be careful of different aspects of the media which could be harmful to them. Pornography, violence, racism, all kinds of moral evils that proliferate all over some of our contemporary media. The internet is infested with all kinds of things, but so are CD-ROMs, DVDs, VCRs. There's lots of good and there's lots of evil out there. We have to be discriminating in terms of using our moral capacity to judge, is this good, is this bad, does this help, does this not. So parents, just don't let your kids surf the web whenever they can. Use the same prudence you would when you give them the car keys. Give limits to where they can go, what time they have to be in with the car. Do the same with the internet. Do the same with any type of modern media, because you don't know what's out there. There's lots of good. There's lots of good out there, as you can see here on EWTN. But there's also bad in other areas. So this document concludes by telling us it is the duty of Catholics to support good Catholic media. Paragraph 17 tells us it'd be shameful if Catholics remain inactive in this regard. So it's our duty to support good Orthodox Catholic media, newspapers, TV, radio. So when you find something good, let them know. When you find something bad, let them know. And choose wisely when you're using these media. This document, while short, does touch upon things that are hitting us in today's society. So I ask you again, read these beautiful documents when you have the chance. Read them again and again and appreciate how valuable our faith is. We want you to know that we're praying for you. Keep watching, and may the good Lord bless you always.